Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 119. Graham Flanagan of Business Insider. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films.
Graham, how you doing today?
Hey, Ben, how are you?
Very good. So we both have seen Jeremy Saulnier's Green Room, and we wanted to get on the phone to talk about it. Before we get into Green Room, have you seen Blue Ruin?
Yes, I finally saw it, rented it on iTunes about 2 weeks ago, because I knew I wanted to see Green Room. And I just wanted to catch up with Blue Ruin, and it's, you know, I'm bummed I've waited that long to see it, because I love Blue Ruin. It was amazing, and so that got me super pumped for Green Room.
Yeah, I was a huge fan of Blue Ruin whenever it hit. I think I saw it on Netflix instant whenever it came out in 2014, and instantly I was like, wow, there's like a Coen Brothers quality to it, but yet it still retains a Southern indie kind of feel to it. I think Green Room retains a lot of that. Obviously it doesn't have a Southern influence, but what did you think of Green Room?
I loved it. I mean, it's definitely one of the best movies of the year this year for me. So that I've seen so far up there with Deadpool and Hail Caesar. It's just definitely at the top of that list. And it was just fantastic. You know, it was exciting, original, looked beautiful. I loved the characters. I loved the performances. I loved the feel of it. The casting was amazing with you know, a lot of unknowns mixed in with some up-and-coming young stars, and then obviously Macon Blair from Blue Ruin in a totally different role. And then you had Sir Patrick Stewart there to lend it some gravitas as the heel villain, one of many heels in the movie. But I mean, I loved everything about it. I loved the music. I loved how it sort of took you into that sort of punk scene, and everything that brought with it. And I loved the production design, the world that they created, in that club, with all the details you see of what people have like written on the walls, and just the grittiness of that place just made it feel real. And that also goes back to the beginning of the movie. It's just all the environments that the movie takes place in, you know, were just so authentic, and it's just a great piece of work.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a total ride. You know, it's like a roller coaster from beginning to end, from the opening shot to the last shot. You're just engaged the entire time, and it's really rare that you get just a stripped down thriller like this, especially that's released to movie theaters. You know, it's something that could have been in a grindhouse theater in the 70s, you know, but we get to see, you know, thankfully, I guess Blue Ruin probably afforded Saulnier the distribution outlet that he got for this one. And it's a really special movie, and I'm with you. I had such a good time watching such horrible things happening, which, you know, there's a level of guilt there. But like you said, you mentioned the kind of uber heel of Darcy in the movie, but in his whole faction. But I think that one of the things that I love about the movie is that while it depicts evil, it never lets us just assume that these guys are pure evil. I think there's probably only one character in the movie that clearly has something wrong with him, where he just has he's clearly a psychopath, you know, the
Worm.
Yeah, exactly, Worm, yeah. And there's an amazing shot. I'll throw out spoilers for the movie. I should have said that up front. There's an amazing shot at the end where, after everything has gone down, you just see Worm in his, like, den with some guy that's overdosed, and he's just, like, eating a bowl of cereal. And it's the most evil guy in the movie, and he's clearly the catalyst for all of this violence and all of this chaos. And at the end of the day, you know, it was just another day for him, and he's totally untouched by everything else that's happened. And I think that speaks to this pretty interesting overall theme that the movie seems to have, which is kind of compliance and complicity and indifference. Like there's a I don't know. It's almost like the violence is essentially just allowing yourself to be complicit in bigger things and not caring. The same way that they're able to separate their convictions from their art and play in a skinhead neo-Nazi, you know, den and not feel bad about that and not feel like they're somehow, you know, supporting that movement. They're being indifferent to what those guys believe, and they pay for that indifference. That same way, Worm is just kind of indifferent to the consequences of his actions. So I don't know. There seems to be just the indifference, and then also there's an amazing shot right around that same time of that dog that gets away, and you're just reminded that it's this animal that doesn't have any stake in what's going on around it. And all it wants to do is come home and snuggle with its owner, who just happens to be dead. I'm not adding everything up perfectly, but it's just, I think it's a really rich movie, not just as an experience, but also just as a story, as a piece of movie making.
Yeah, that's a great point that I hadn't really thought of. You root for the band members in this story to survive and get away, and they're certainly the underdogs. But that being said, what gives them sort of a tweener status is that at the beginning, you know, they're obviously desperate for gas money to get back to across the country to Virginia, where they're from Oregon, and they get a gig playing at what is clearly described to them as a skinhead bar, and they basically say, "Oh, that's okay. There's some at every show." And, you know, basically they had a chance. They could have said, wait, so it's a, you know, we realize that there are skinheads at every show, every punk show, and that's a, you know, negative aspect of the scene. But this is a skinhead bar, like purely a bar for skinheads to come and be together. No, we're not going to take that. But they didn't do that. They were desperate for the money. And that sort of, you know, explains, it doesn't justify by any means what happens to all but one of them. But, you know, if you're looking at it from sort of a, you know, a deus ex machina sort of perspective, it's like they definitely put themselves in that position by allowing themselves to be the entertainment for these evil people. So that's an interesting way to think of it. So in a way that they were complicit in what went down in the end.
Yeah, and they're so interested in what's real and what's authentic, but then they kind of get confronted with, you know, it's a shoot, you know. I mean, they kind of live in kayfabe where they're these kind of punk kids that are real tough and real sincere and legit, but then they get in this shoot environment and you know they get worked. Basically.
Well, they show that, and it's exposed too. Their real identities are exposed, and with this theme of what's your desert island band, that is brought up very entertainingly and effectively throughout the movie. And initially, a lot of them, some of them say these, you know, when they're asked what are your desert island bands in a radio interview at the beginning of the film, some of them say these just punk bands that will make them look cool and authentic, and then later when they're sort of in a more vulnerable position, a couple of them change their tune and just say Simon and Garfunkel and Prince. You know, so they now that they're in a vulnerable position, you're seeing who they really are. It's also a great point. One of them does say stick to the Misfits, so he's real.
Yeah.
But it's a great point. It's about how, you know, your identity changes when you're put in different types of scenarios.
I love the speaking of just kind of like you know, the real aspect of things coming through. Whenever Anton Yelchin's character, I think his name is Pat, has to negotiate with Darcy through the door, for some reason they kind of pick him as the spokesperson. But as soon as he's taught, like the way Anton Yelchin plays it, he is like bawling. You know, he can barely get words out. He's so emotional, and I feel like that's something fresh and new that you don't see in these kind of movies very often. you know, where it's just this guy that is, it's a human being that is just totally falling apart because of the stress of the situation. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of, or it made me think of The Martian. One of my issues with that movie is that it's this intense situation, and despite him being a, you know, exquisitely intelligent and evolved scientist, there's never a real moment in The Martian where you feel like the gravity of the situation is registering with him. But here you have this normal guy who is faced with this tremendous danger, and he can't even hold it together. And I think that is a great choice by Saulnier and a great choice by Yelchin to play that way.
Yeah, this is definitely my favorite performance of his so far. I was a little skeptical coming into it based on just, you know, I just hadn't been a huge fan of any of his performances, but he really showed he's a real thing in this environment. And absolutely, this movie made you feel like you were really there. It you felt like the stakes were high. You felt like you, along with the band members, were in danger. And, you know, another thing that I thought made that even more effective, or, you know, helped to create that feeling, was that they didn't hit you over the head with details and backstory about who these guys, these skinheads, are and what they do and what they're all about. I mean, we just get a very surface level sort of exposure to what they're sort of into. And, you know, not only because of how they look, a lot of them look and their tattoos, but, you know, very effective production design in terms of, you know, graffiti written on the wall here and there. And then like in the sort of the office of the rock club in this trailer, you just see in the background, this what appears to be a Nazi flag. That's just, you know, it's wrinkled. It's not like stretched out to where you can see the whole thing. It's sort of just hanging there, but you can tell it's unmistakable what it is. And when you catch those little details, it all adds up to make it feel very real, you know, and that much more terrifying that there exists evil, you know, in America, people like this, and this is very much a believable environment for them. So that's the main thing that was so effective here. You know, obviously he's a burgeoning master of suspense, Saulnier is, but his ability to create these environments and these worlds with, you know, very small budgets. This was like, I think, a $5 million movie, and I think Blue Rune was under $1 million.
I think it was Kickstarter. I think part of Blue Rune was funded by a Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that wasn't even, a lot of that budget wasn't even for the actual production. It was for, you know, a lot of the post-production, the sound mix and the color grading and just delivering a final cut. So he has shown, and I had yet to see Murder Party, his first feature, I don't think any of his short work, commercial work, et cetera, but, you know, what he's been able to do with very limited resources just makes you excited to see what he will do with you know, a bigger budget moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, this is totally unsubstantiated. I can't remember where I heard it, but I feel like I remember reading somewhere that he, after Blue Ruin, I think like Marvel or some other big studio like offered him a franchise movie, and he turned it down and said, no, I want to keep kind of on, you know, I want to keep naturally growing my career at this level. And I think that if that's true, that's pretty amazing, you know, that he didn't bail from the indie scene, but he continued to kind of follow whatever track he's on right now and find his voice that way. I think that's pretty unique, and I think he makes a lot of really unique choices. Real quick, let's just kind of, if you have a second, you want to hit just a few of your favorite moments in the movie. Do you have time for that?
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you start?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to mention is, again, going back to Saulnier, just his choice to use, like, standard Hollywood cliches and then just not deliver on them at all. There's this moment where one of the characters gets mauled by a Rottweiler and is left for dead. He's not dead, and we see that he's not dead, and he looks over and he sees, like, a shotgun under the bar, and you expect going forward, you expect him to save our heroes at one point, you know, being like standing, like leaning against a wall, bleeding from the neck, and he's got that shotgun and he shoots a bad guy and he saves the good guys and kind of keeps going. And then that never happens. The next time we see him, he has died and his body is being pulled across the ground. And that shotgun comes back later, but in a completely shocking way. That whole little bit, him seeing the shotgun, it not being delivered, and then the way that the shotgun is used to take out a character that we expect to see much more of going forward, that it's just one of those things where it's like, wow, I'm seeing something that I don't usually see in a movie.
Yeah, and another interesting choice, which is discussed at length in a great interview that Saulnier did on the Q&A podcast with Jeff Goldsmith, which any fan of this movie should listen to. It's my favorite interview that I've heard yet from Saulnier based on this movie, is the choice to have that big, long negotiation scene with Patrick Stewart on one side of the door and all the band members on the other, and we never see Patrick Stewart at all. And
yeah.
It never cuts over to him, and we never really see what's going on the other side. And we never see it, except for that one glimpse through that the openings in the door where we see the red laces standing there, which
yeah.
is just the first, you know, that's amazing. It's like that's the first thing we see on the other side after this negotiation's been going on. And that helped to build up the tension so much. Not, you know, because you're with the band and you have no idea what's on the other side of that door. And we'd already seen Patrick Stewart's character at this point. It would have, you know, made sense for them to cut back and forth. But I just thought that choice was so effective in heightening the suspense. And, you know, when it all pays off, when we don't even see what happens to Anton Yelchin's arm, but something terrible does, and we see the result of it, which is just horrifying. So that's just great. Those choices there were unexpected, original, and you know, those of a strong voice and filmmaker for sure.
Yeah, the I will say that I think that Patrick Stewart's introduction in the movie fell a little bit flat for me. It does definitely seem like they talk about him before he's on screen in a Orson Welles Third Man kind of way, and you kind mm-hmm. of expect it to be this big payoff when we first see him. And really, I mean, he's just kind of introduced in the side profile shot sitting in his truck. So I'm wondering if that was an intentional thing on Saulnier's part, or he just wondering why he didn't decide to give him that big kind of, I don't know, low angle introduction shot.
See the back of his head. They do frame the back of his head and shoot, you know, they focus on the back of his bald head, like for a few seconds at least before it turns around to try and build up the reveal.
Yeah.
But I do agree that it's interesting. They could have just had that, they could have like waited to really reveal him until after the big negotiation scene, but
exactly,
in the moment, to me, it worked, and you know, I really don't have a huge gripe with that.
Yeah, I mean, the whole movie develops so organically, it's kind of hard to expect it to have those kind of big moments. You know, it's really not a movie necessarily made of moments. It's just kind of, it's just one thing happens after the other, and at the end
yeah.
of it, you realize you've had this experience.
Yeah, again, he talks at length about how with this production, since it was a little bit bigger where you're dealing with multi-millions of dollars and he had a union crew, how, you know, even though it was a very small film compared to a lot of films that are playing in multiplexes where I saw this movie today, he felt like, you know, he had to play a completely different game than he did with Blue Ruin, where it was so small and it was just buddies helping him make the movie. And he did absolutely have complete control. He describes the process in this interview like it was stressful for him. But, man, it really turned out well and just goes to show that a la Hobbit and the Battle of the Five Armies, that when things aren't going well behind the scenes, that it can be tied into a beautiful bow at the end and work out really well.
Yeah, and I mean, talking about the location again, I think they built that whole set. And it's a place that, I mean, being such a square as I am, like, just being there with nobody in that building, I would be terrified, you know? And they did
yeah.
such a good job of setting that up. With the sound design, it's so great where you hear the other bands playing through the
yeah.
walls while stuff is going down. And then, of course, the location photography in the Oregon forest is all, like you said earlier, it's just all beautiful. And the final beat of the movie is pretty great. You know, that final line where...
Oh, yeah.
I know we're talking spoilers, but I don't even want to get into it. It's just a bit from, like I said, from beginning to end. The one thing I'm wondering is if the first shot of the movie is Anton Yelchin's character sleeping, and he's like sleeping on his arm, and I'm wondering if he's sleeping on the arm that almost gets chopped off. I feel like that's the kind of decision that Saulnier would make for his opening shot. So I'm curious. It's a movie that's so violent that I definitely got squeamish at certain parts. There's not a ton of violence, but when it does get violent, it's legit. I feel like it wouldn't be that fun of a movie to watch again, but the more I think about it, the more I want to watch it again. I think that's definitely a good sign.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great film. Everybody should see it. And there's a lot of exciting movies in the independent scene right now. It's a weird to be able to say that at this time of year, but it's a very exciting time for movies like this. And I cannot wait to see what Saulnier does next.
Me too. Hey, so how about that Macon Blair face turn?
I guess you could see that coming, but you know, he just, those eyes, those puppy dog eyes, you know, it's obvious he's not a true heel. I mean, he's a baby face at heart.
Yeah, he doesn't have the red laces. He doesn't earn them.
No, I don't think he really wanted them in the first place.
Did you read the rumors that they were thinking of giving Doc Gallows and Carl Anderson red lace boots at Extreme Rules?
Oh my God.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.